satellite image is clearer than last time. He keeps saying he's sorry and he didn't mean to hurt me. Slowly, I soften my tone, but wonder if he's being nice to me under sufferance. I know you're still getting used to the idea, I say, but you're going to be a great dad. He flinches around his eyes. Listen, Agatha, call me Aggie. Right, Aggie. He rocks forward. I accept that I'm probably the father. You are, and I respect your decision to have the baby. Thank you. But I'm not going to marry you.
I didn't ask you to marry me. I haven't asked you for anything.
I know, I know. I talked to my folks. They made me realize that I've said all the wrong things. I mean, it came as a shock, the baby.
You're telling me, I reply, giggling nervously.
I've had time to think and make some decisions.
I'm happy to raise this baby on my own if that's what you decide. But if you did want to play a part, I think you should have that right. I mean, how horrible would it be if you really wanted a baby and I didn't tell you that you were a father?
He nods in grim acceptance. The silence stretches out.
Your mum and dad are nice, I say.
They don't have any grandchildren.
I'm happy to let them help me. It's not about the money, but I am going to struggle to pay the rent when the baby's born. Then there are expenses.
How much do you need?
If I tell the government, they'll make you pay child support.
How much?
100 quid a week.
His eyes squeeze shut. Fine. So when are you due?
Early December, but it could be sooner.
I'm not home until Christmas.
That's okay. My mother is going to be my birth partner. I hold up an ultrasound picture. Can you see it?
Hayden leans closer to the screen.
That's his head, and there are his little arms and legs. He's all curled up.
Is it a boy?
Uh-huh. Hey, do you want to see me?
I stand up and turn side onto the webcam, holding my dress down and running my hands over my stomach.
Pretty big bump, huh? You should see my rock star boobs.
Shame I'm not there to play with them, says Hayden.
Cheeky sod, I say, sitting down again.
My hands slide higher, cupping my breasts.
They are pretty big.
They were always pretty big.
Do you want to see them?
He glances over his shoulder. Someone might see.
A quick peek?
I pull down the top of my dress and lift the cups of my bra. His eyes go wide.
My nipples are extra sensitive. I can feel the fabric rubbing back and forth over them. Makes me horny.
You better cover up, he says, his voice growing thicker. I push my chair back from the screen and slide my dress a little higher, rocking my legs open and closed. Hayden looks ready to crawl through the screen.
I'm not wearing knickers.
His breath catches. He utters a groan. Poor boy. He's been at sea for 7 months. He adjusts something in his lap.
Are you touching yourself?
I ask, grinning at him.
I wish I was there. I'd do it for you. I've been ever so lonely. If I were there, I'd run my fingers along your thighs, inching them closer, bit by bit. Oh, yes.
Would you like that? His breathing has grown ragged.
Say it.
Yes.
Yes, what?
I'd like that.
I slide my hands beneath my dress. Oh, I wish you were here right now. I'd let you fuck another baby into me.
I open my thighs wider.
I can feel you. I can feel you inside me. So big. So hard. Oh, yes. Yes. Harder. I need you to touch me. Please, please, Hayden. Fill me up. Fuck me. Yes. Yes. Harder.
I hear a different groan and the sound of a man dying a little death. Hayden's eyes are glazed and heavy-lidded. He looks at his lap, horrified.
Let's talk again soon, lover, I say.
He doesn't answer.
Megan. I'm upstairs going through old baby clothes in the attic, wishing I'd put labels on the boxes instead of just throwing everything inside. I should put some of this stuff on eBay. I have the full DVD collections of Sex and the City and The West Wing, which may be worth something. Do people buy DVDs anymore? What about second-hand ski boots? The doorbell sounds. Why do people always ring when I'm upstairs? Navigating the lumps of Play-Doh and odd bits of Lego on the stairs, I reach the front door. This had better not be a salesman. I turn the latch. Simon Kidd smiles at me from behind a huge bunch of roses that have lost petals on the journey. Hello, Megs. I don't answer, but my heart feels like a taiko drum.
I bought you these, he says, slurring his words.
Are you drunk?
I had a long lunch.
Jack isn't here.
I know. We need to talk.
No, we have nothing to say to each other.
It's about the baby.
My heart lurches. I try to close the door, but he steps forward and braces his palms against it.
You rang me and asked me whether we used a condom that night.
It doesn't matter.
The condom broke.
What?
It broke. I didn't tell you because I didn't think it was...
He is staring into my eyes as though hoping I might finish the statement. I'm shocked, but won't let him see it. You're right. It's not important. Please go away.
I've been thinking about you.
What?
About that night.
Christ, Simon, it was sex. A one-night stand. Not even that. A mistake. An embarrassment. He looks miserable.
It was more than that for me.
What does that mean? Simon lowers his eyes, looking at the flowers, whispering.
What if the baby is mine?
It's not.
You don't know if it's Jack's.
Yes, I do.
If you knew that, you wouldn't have asked me if we used a condom.
It's Jack's baby, okay? I don't want to mention this ever again. We agreed.
I need to know if it's mine.
What?
I need to know.
Simon gives me his lost puppy look. I make a strange, unworldly gurgle in my throat. Why would you risk my marriage, your friendship with Jack?
I want you...
He doesn't finish.
I want to be your father.
Fine. Ask Gina to marry you. Get her knocked up. Leave me out of this.
You don't understand.
My voice is getting louder. No, you don't understand. This is my home. This is my family. I am having Jack's baby. You have no right to come here and ask me these questions. I'm crying now, tears of frustration and anger. I want to hit Simon. I want to hurt him. But mostly, I want to make him go away. He steps back and I slam the door, turning the key in the deadlock and bracing my back against the heavy wood. Sliding to the floor, I sit on the inner doormat, my shoulders shaking, frightened of what I've done. We don't have extramarital affairs in my family. We don't have one-night stands or wild flings. Braced against the cold door, my knees bunched up, I stare at the polished floorboards of the hallway. What if Jack finds out? What if the baby is Simon's? I've been stupid, but I don't deserve this grief. I've been a good wife. I love Jack. I shouldn't be punished for one mistake. Agatha. I haven't seen Meg in almost a week. She didn't meet up with her mother's group this morning and hasn't come into the supermarket. Her last blog post went up 10 days ago, and none of the comments have been liked or acknowledged. I wanted to wait outside Lachlan's preschool this afternoon, but Mr. Patel kept me back because we had a delivery. I had to take an inventory of every box because he's convinced our suppliers are shorting us. Finally, he lets me go. Unclipping my name tag, I take off my smock and stash them in the usual place before hurrying across Barnes Green, past the pond and the church, turning left and right through the streets until I reach Cleveland Gardens. Meg's car is parked outside the house. The front curtains are open, but I can't see anyone inside. I cut through to Beverly Path and walk as far as the railway underpass before climbing the fence and following the railway tracks. When I reach the right house, I crawl through the undergrowth and climb onto my favourite fallen tree. There are toys outside the Wendy house, but the French doors are shut up, and there's no sign of anyone downstairs. I contemplate calling the home phone. What would I say? I could hang up if Meg answered. At least I'd know she was there. I take out my mobile and look for the number. My thumb hovers over the green button. I glance again at the house and notice a shadow moving behind a curtain upstairs. I wait, watching, hoping she might appear. There she is. I feel a surge of relief. She's healthy, pregnant, perfect. She's in the kitchen, opening the fridge door, taking out ingredients. I relax and lean back against the trunk of the tree, happy again, able to breathe comfortably and dream. My biggest flaw is my attraction to people. I find somebody new and attach myself, desperate for a friend. That's why I've been so careful around Meg, watching from a distance rather than getting too close. I know her timetable, her friends, her habits, and the rhythm of her life. I know where she shops for groceries. I know her favourite coffee shops, her family GP, her hairdresser, her younger sister and where her parents live, all the connections and intersections, the geography and topography of her life. I think I'd make a good spy, because I'm gloriously bland, as adaptable as water, able to flow into spaces and settle into cracks, becoming so smooth and still that I reflect my surroundings. I learned how to do that as a child, when I was rarely seen and less often heard. I tell people I grew up in foster care, but that's only partially true. When it comes to my past, people get some of the truth, some of the time. My real father disappeared on the day I was born. He dropped my mother at the hospital, went home, packed his things, and cleaned out her bank account. Who says chivalry is dead? It was just the two of us, Mum and me, till I was four. That's when she started going to Bible studies and became a Jehovah's Witness. I had to become one too. No more holidays, no more birthdays, no more Christmases or Easters. I didn't mind. It didn't matter which religion I chose to reject later. But my mother embraced it wholeheartedly because it offered her a community. We went to weekly services at Kingdom Hall, which were called meetings, and sang Kingdom songs praising Jehovah. I had scripture classes that taught me about the truth and how the rest of society was morally corrupt and under the influence of Satan. Within a year, my mother married one of the elders from the church. She became a trophy wife, sailing through life in her Hermes scarf, faultlessly charming, always reaching for the next rung on the social ladder. I have no doubt that she loved my stepfather, who did tax returns from a small office above a furniture store in Leeds. She was ambitious for him, prodding and cajoling and networking until his business grew and we moved into a bigger house. Elijah was born when I was six. I loved him, and he loved me. I became his second mother, pushing him around in his pram and spoon-feeding him in his high chair. Later I would dress him up, and we married under the willow tree in the back garden. At age three, he became sick and spent 2 months in hospital. My mother and stepfather took turns sleeping by his bed and barely saw each other as they passed in the night and the day. Elijah got better. Life carried on. But my parents watched him more closely after that, letting their anxiety show in dozens of small ways. I grew older. Elijah kept pace. He was like a shadow, following me around, asking me endless questions that I couldn't possibly answer. What if whales could walk? Are there dinosaurs in heaven? Where does the light go when you turn it off? Usually I made stuff up and his little face would beam with pleasure when he learned something new, even complete bollocks. Occasionally he made me angry and I yelled. Elijah's mouth would turn down in a perfect frown and tears would pool in his eyes. I hated myself for that. He turned five and started school. I had to walk with him every day, holding his hand at intersections as he bounced up and down in his new shoes, wanting to run ahead. My friends thought he was cute. I thought he was embarrassing. On show and tell day, Elijah brought a castle that he'd made from shoeboxes and bog rolls. He needed both hands to carry it and could barely see over the top of the turrets.
"Hurry up! Hurry up!
he said, excited to get to school. He waited at each intersection, knowing I was supposed to hold his hand. Once we'd crossed, he ran on, the turret swaying above his head. Nobody saw exactly what happened next. I heard the high-pitched squeal of tires against tarmac and turned my head as Elijah bent against the car bonnet and sprang back again. He turned in midair and for a moment seemed to be looking directly at me. The cardboard castle disintegrated against the windscreen. Elijah landed on the road and his head snapped in a different direction. He came to rest on his back, with one leg twisted beneath him at a strange angle. I could see a bone poking out through a ripped hole in his trousers. Like an explosion in reverse, people were sucked inwards, appearing from nearby buildings and cars. I cradled Elijah's head in the crook of my arm. He lay, looking up at me, a scattering of freckles across his nose and cheeks, and a cold fog clouding his eyes.
"What happened to his shoe?" I asked someone. "He can't lose a shoe. They're brand new. My mum will be angry."
The driver, Mrs. McNeil, had a daughter in my class. We found out later it was her birthday. She hit Elijah at 35 miles per hour, 15 over the speed limit in a school zone, but was never charged. The paramedics came, but they didn't take Elijah away. They put curtains around him and left him lying in the street for hours, taking photographs and interviewing witnesses. People assured me it wasn't my fault, and that Elijah had run out onto the road. My parents arrived. My stepfather took off his glasses so he could sob into his cupped hands. Meanwhile, my mother kept asking,
"Where were you, Aggie? Why weren't you holding his hand?" "He was carrying his castle," I said.
But that was no excuse. Later, whenever a therapist asked me what I most wanted from our sessions, I told them, to be normal. "What makes you think you're not normal?" "I killed my brother." "That was an accident. I should have held his hand." From the day Elijah died, it was clear to me that God or fate had made the wrong choice. If my mother and stepfather were going to lose a child, why couldn't it have been me? That might sound melodramatic or self-loathing, but the truth cuts deeper than the lie. Elijah's death stole all the oxygen in our family, and nothing I did would ever allow my parents to breathe easily again. I could have blitzed my exams, helped old ladies across the street, rescued cats from trees, and cured cancer. But none of it would have mattered. Dead or alive, my half-brother could do no wrong, while I could do no right. I could understand my stepfather loving me less than Elijah, but not my mother. Why did she mourn Elijah and ignore me? I wanted to scream at her. I wanted to bite and scratch and pinch to generate some emotion or recognition that I counted too. Although I didn't realize it yet, Jehovah had turned his back on me long before I turned my back on him. Megan. I wake with a start, my heart pounding and panic filling my throat with cotton wool. I dreamed my baby came out looking exactly like Simon, with smoky grey eyes, sharp cheekbones, and dark hair parted on the left. He was wearing a rumpled linen jacket and brogues, baby-sized, and had a designer stubble shading his jawline. What sort of wife sleeps with her husband's best friend? I'm not some 16-year-old groupie at a rock concert, throwing myself at the drummer because the lead singer is already taken. I'm not a sex-starved housewife who flirts with tradesmen or answers the door naked under her housecoat. I don't even own a housecoat. Jack rolls over and puts his hand across my chest. His fingers cup my right breast. My heart slows. I breathe. Close my eyes. Drift off. His hand drifts lower, over the rising slope of my belly and down the other side between my thighs. He snuggles closer. I feel his erection. That's more like it. I raise my hips, and he pulls off my knickers. His boxer shorts go twirling through the air.
What is Daddy doing?
Asks Lucy, who is standing with one hand on the doorknob and the other holding a bunny.
Nothing, says Jack, covering up.
Go back to bed,
I tell her.
I'm not sleepy.
Go downstairs and watch cartoons.
Lachlan wet the bed.
How do you know?
The smell.
She wrinkles her nose and waits for me to do something. I pull down my nightdress and swing my legs out of bed. Jack groans. I lean over and kiss his cheek, whispering,
Wait here.
I can't, he says. I'm being picked up at 7.
When will you be home?
Not until late. By the time I get back to the bedroom, he's showered, shaved, and is answering emails on his phone. The car arrives. He kisses each of the children. I get the same peck, but no words of encouragement or secret squeeze. I envy him going off to work, talking to adults about grown-up things. Okay, I don't regard sport as being a grown-up subject, but it beats the hell out of discussing tantrums, toddler recipes, and teething trouble with a group of mothers who subtly try to one-up each other, complaining about their precocious offspring, calling them too clever for their own good, by which they mean cleverer than other children. Neither of my kids is a budding Einstein. Lachlan once shoved a sultana up his nose, and we spent 4 hours in accident and emergency, and Lucy swallowed a pound, which meant squeezing her stools for a week to make sure it passed. This morning, they're being particularly obstreperous. Clothes are rejected, breakfast orders are rescinded, negotiations are undertaken, and squabbles are nipped in the bud. Lachlan wants to wear his Wellingtons, and Lucy insists her space buns are crooked and make her look lopsided. I blame Jack for showing her Star Wars. Leaving the house late, I rush across the green, dragging them along while they complain and bicker. As I near the pond, I notice someone standing between the trees. I recognize her from somewhere but can't think of where or why. I kiss Lucy at the school gates and drop Lachlan at his preschool. Today he decides to latch on to my leg, begging me not to leave. One of the staff distracts him long enough for me to slip away. As I'm folding up the pushchair, I catch sight of two mothers whispering and stealing glances at me. They look away guiltily. Is something wrong? I ask.
No, nothing,
says one of them, curling her top lip. I hear them laughing as I leave. I want to know what they're saying, but it's not worth the effort. I have a whole 5 hours in which to cook, clean, shop, wash, and iron before I get to have some Meg time. First, I have an appointment to see an obstetrician, Mr. Phillips, who has consulting rooms on the lower floor of a large Victorian house near the river. My GP made the referral because of complications when I had Lucy and Lachlan. Nothing particularly serious. Their heads were too big, my pelvis was too small. Something had to give. Mr. Phillips has a waiting room covered with testimonials, photographs, and cards from satisfied patients, thanking him for delivering their precious gift, as though he'd personally arranged the conception, pregnancy, and birth. Reassuringly middle-aged, he has pebble spectacles and a slight overbite that makes his mouth the most interesting feature on his face. I wonder if he's married. If so, what does his wife think about this part of his job, looking at other women's bits? I can imagine him getting home and not wanting to look at another vagina. This sets me giggling, and I can't stop, even when he's palpating my womb.
He's almost crowning, he tells me. Not long now.
Thank God, I mumble. He goes to his desk and types notes on his computer. I pull down my dress and take a seat opposite.
We do need to discuss the birth, he says,
clasping his fingers on his small potbelly.
I know you were hoping to have another natural birth, but you tore in both previous deliveries.
Maybe I won't tear this time.
That's highly unlikely, and stitching you again will be more difficult. I think you should seriously consider a cesarean.
I'm struggling with this, not because of political correctness or the idea that I'll be judged by other mothers as being too posh to push. Twice before I've done things the old-fashioned way, which hurt like hell, but it gave me a tremendous sense of satisfaction. How long would I have to stay in hospital?
I ask. Without complications, you're looking at 3 to 4 days.
And that's what you recommend?
Absolutely.
Mr. Phillips opens his diary on screen.
We can bring you into hospital early on Thursday, December 7th, and operate first thing.
I want to argue, but I know he's right.
Talk to your husband. If there's a problem with that date, give my office a call. Otherwise, I'll see you then.
Agatha. At 13, I was baptized as a Jehovah's Witness. It meant I could go door to door and help others repent their sins and live in peace on earth. In the months leading up to the baptism, I attended scripture classes. My teacher, Mr. Bowler, was a church elder with a moon face and a pudding bowl haircut that made his name seem very apt. He talked a lot about God's kingdom and Armageddon, who I thought must be an apostle because the scriptures kept saying, Armageddon is coming. Mr. Bowler had 4 daughters and owned a clothing store in Leeds. His youngest daughter, Bernie, was a year above me at school, but we weren't really friends. After my baptism, I continued going to Kingdom Hall twice a week, where Mr. Bowler helped me with my maths and science homework. He also read my English texts in advance and helped me write essays. One day, he asked me if I would go door to door with him, distributing The Watchtower, which was the church's magazine. I wanted to be the best Jehovah's Witness I could be, so we walked the streets and stood on doorsteps, telling people they could live forever in paradise if they woke up to the truth. Most of them were annoyed, but didn't say anything nasty because I was so young. It grew dark and started to rain. We had to run. I laughed. Mr. Bowler bought fish and chips. We ate them in the basement of Kingdom Hall, licking salt and vinegar from our fingers. I shivered.
You're cold, he said. You should take off those wet clothes.
He tried to unbutton my blouse. I told him no. He tickled me, pressing me down. He kissed me on the lips. He said he loved me. I said I loved him too. It was true. I did. He'd been nicer to me than anyone I'd ever known. I wanted him to be my father, but he had his own daughters. I remember the musty smell of the sofa and the rough fabric of the upholstery itching my skin. My dress had ridden up to the top of my thighs. His fingernails were scrabbling at my knickers. I pushed his hand away. He said that when 2 people love each other, they did more than kiss. They took off their clothes. They touched. He kissed me again. I didn't like the fat wetness of his tongue, which tasted of cod and vinegar. I knew what he wanted. I'd heard girls talking. He took my hand and moved it up and down. He sighed. He shook. He wiped it off with his handkerchief.
"This will be our secret," he said. "Nobody else would understand."
Why must it always be a secret? The next time we went door-knocking, he gave me a bracelet engraved with a message, "There is no cure." "To what?" I asked.
"To love," he replied.
Afterwards, we went back to the basement at Kingdom Hall. We sat on the sofa. He pushed the same fat, wet tongue into my mouth and forced his knee between my thighs. I didn't like the kissing. I didn't like his weight, or the pain, or the shame. So I burrowed inside myself and hid in the shadows.
"Open your eyes, princess," he said. "I want you to look at me."
"Please don't do that."
"Isn't this nice?"
"No, you're hurting me."
"You're a proper woman now."
"Can't we go back to the way it was before?" I vomited the fish and chips. He reared back as though scalded, swearing at the mess on his clothes. Marching me into the small, stark bathroom, he made me undress. I stood naked on the freezing floor and noticed the semen and blood on my thighs. I cried. He said he was sorry. I felt sad for him. In the weeks and months that followed, we knocked on many more doors without saving any souls. We had sex in the basement afterwards, and Mr. Bowler said that when I turned 17, we were going to run away together and live in a house by the sea. He showed me photographs of pretty cottages covered in wisteria or ivy. In the meantime, We had to keep our love secret because he was married. That summer, Mr. Bowler took his family to Cornwall for a holiday. I thought I'd be relieved, but instead I missed him and couldn't wait for him to come home. He brought me another present, a fossil of a snail that was millions of years old, and he said our love would last that long. I knew that wasn't true. I grew more silent as the weeks passed.
"Where's that pretty smile?"
he'd ask, and I would try to smile.
"You like this, don't you?"
he'd say, as his hot breath puffed against my face.
"Tell me you like it."
One day, he asked me if his youngest daughter Bernie had a boyfriend, or if any boys had shown an interest in her. I didn't know. He became quite agitated at the thought of some grubby teenager pawing her, and asked me to spy on her and report back to him. I recognized the hypocrisy. He thought it was okay to have sex with me, but his daughter had to remain pure. I watched Bernie in the playground, chatting and laughing with her friends. She was pretty and popular, and excited to be alive. I knew I would never be like that again. Never clean or happy. Mr. Bowler had sex with me for another year, never using a condom, always withdrawing from me at the last second. When he finished, he buckled his belt and told me to clean up before he took me home. One evening, as he seesawed into me, I felt my mind separate from my body and float upwards. Looking down on the room, I could see Mr. Bowler's white buttocks and the corduroy trousers around his ankles and sleeveless sweater his wife had knitted him. I opened my mouth to scream, but no sound came out. Instead, I felt a creature slide down my spine and slither between my organs until it curled around my heart, stopping it from breaking. I came to with Mr. Bowler slapping my cheek and calling my name. I didn't want to wake.
"You must have blacked out," he said, zipping up his fly. "You made a strange sound as though you were talking to someone, but it wasn't your voice. I hope you don't talk in your sleep at home."
Mr. Bowler no longer helped me with my homework or asked me to go door knocking. And as the weeks passed, he found more and more things to criticize about me. My skin, my weight, my smell. He didn't kiss me anymore or tell me he loved me. The creature woke and slept and slithered inside me, whispering advice, scribbling spidery words on the pages of my diary, laughing at my feeble attempts to express my feelings.
"Nobody cares what you think."
"Mr. Bowler cares."
"He doesn't love you. He thinks you're getting fat."
"No."
"That's why he pinches the rolls of fat above your hips. He finds you disgusting."
"He loves me."
"He doesn't kiss you. He doesn't buy you presents. He doesn't take you door knocking."
I turned 15. There was no birthday celebration. My mother asked me about my last period. She gasped when the doctor confirmed I was pregnant. My stepfather demanded to know the name of the father. I shook my head. He looped my hair around his closed fist and lifted me off my feet. I remember the look on their faces. Shock. Disbelief. I was sent to my room, where I sat on the bed and listened to them arguing. My mother wanted to call the police, but my stepfather said the elders would know what to do. I scratched at the Little Mermaid stencil on my bedhead, slowly peeling it away. The notion that I was carrying a baby seemed ridiculous. I still had a dollhouse and a dress-up box. The following day, my parents received a phone call, and I heard my stepfather ask,
"Is it a judicial committee hearing?"
I didn't hear the answer. I was taken to Kingdom Hall and interviewed by three elders who I'd known since I was a child. Brother Wendell ran a carpet cleaning business. Brother Watson installed blinds. And Brother Brookfield worked as a gardener for the local council. They asked me questions. When did I have sex? Where? How often? Was Mr. Bowler circumcised? I didn't know what that meant.
"How far were your legs apart?"
asked Brother Brookfield, who had a face like a tomato.
"Pardon?"
"Show us how far your legs were apart."
I was sitting on a hard wooden chair wearing a knee-length dress. The elders were lined up along a long table. I opened my knees. They leaned forward.
"She must be lying," said Brother Wendell. "How could she be raped with her legs like that?"
"Why didn't you tell your parents?" asked Brother Watson.
"Mr. Bowler said he loved me."
Brother Wendell scoffed.
"So you willingly had sex with him?"
"No, yes, I didn't enjoy it, not the sex."
"Did you tell anyone else?" asked Brother Watson.
"No."
"Did anyone see this happen?"
"We kept it a secret. Mr. Bowler said when I was 17 we would run away together and live in a house by the sea. He showed me pictures." I thought they might laugh.
"When was the first time?" asked Brother Brookfield.
"I don't remember the exact date."
"Were you a virgin?"
"Yes."
"Surely you must remember the date," said Brother Wendell. "The week, the month."
I struggled to think, eventually guessing a date. "Around Easter," I whispered.
"You don't sound very sure."
"I think it was around then."
The elders left me alone. I wanted to go to the bathroom, but I was too scared to ask. Instead, I crossed my legs, squeezing everything shut. Soon, I heard Mr. Bowler shouting in another room, accusing me of telling lies. A little bit of wee came out. When the elders came back, they had my parents with them. Mr. Bowler entered through a separate door. Before it closed, I saw his daughter Bernie standing behind him. She was holding her mother's hand. The judicial committee took their seats at a long table. My stepfather sat behind me, and my mother stood just inside the main doors, looking bewildered. Brother Wendell spoke first.
"Very serious allegations have been made against Brother Bowler, a senior member of our flock. Sister Agatha is pregnant. She claims that on more than one occasion, Brother Bowler fornicated with her and made her perform other sexual acts. Brother Bowler denies any wrongdoing and has made a counter-complaint against Sister Agatha, accusing her of slander. He has asked for permission to question his accuser."
I thought I was going to vomit. Mr. Bowler crossed the room and stood directly in front of me. He wore familiar corduroy trousers and a sleeveless sweater. Smiling kindly, he said hello, telling me he was sorry to see me in such circumstances.
"Do you have a boyfriend?"
"No."
"So you haven't had sex with a worldly boy from your school?"
"No."
"You are lying, sister."
"No."
"You came to me and confessed to me 6 weeks ago. I told you that the watchtower forbids such acts. I counseled you. I warned you to stay away from this boy, but you failed to listen."
"No." I looked at my mother. "It's not true."
"My daughter Bernie has confirmed it," said Mr. Bowler. "You admitted it to her."
I was shaking my head, trying to think clearly. Why would Bernie say I had a boyfriend?
"Do you know what a lie is, Agatha?" asked Mr. Bowler.
"Yes."
"You told your parents you were going door to door with me. Was that a lie?"
"Yes."
"So you lie when it's convenient for you?"
"No, yes, I don't know."
"You told the judicial committee that I first had sex with you at Easter 2 years ago. I have my diary here, which shows that I was away at a trade fair for a week over Easter."
My mouth opened and closed. I couldn't remember the date.
"So were you lying about that?"
"No, I mean, I wasn't sure."
"So when you're not sure about something, you tell a lie?"
"No."
"Were you lying to the committee, or are you lying to me?"
"That's enough!" yelled a voice from the back of the hall. My mother marched down the center aisle, gripping her handbag. Normally so meek and submissive, she fixed her gaze on the elders and declared, "Agatha has answered your questions. Make a decision so I can take her home." Nobody tried to argue, not even Mr. Bowler. The committee retired to consider its verdict. I went to the bathroom and washed out my knickers, holding them under the hand dryer. An hour passed. The committee returned.
I was told to stand, but I didn't think my legs could hold me. My mother and stepfather remained in their seats. Brother Wendell had a Bible with him. He didn't look at me.
The scriptures say in Timothy 5:19, do not admit an accusation against an older man, except only on the evidence of 2 or 3 witnesses. In the case before us, Sister Agatha is the only witness against Brother Bowler. This is not to say that she is lying or that Brother Bowler is lying, but the Watchtower policy states that 2 witnesses or a confession are necessary to prove allegations of this nature. Since none of these rules of evidence have been met, the Judicial Committee will take no further action, and the matter is left in Jehovah's hands.
Mr. Bowler stood and announced himself unsatisfied.
I am an esteemed elder of this church, and Sister Agatha has grievously wronged me. She is a false accuser who has had sexual relations outside of marriage with a worldly boy. She is unrepentant. I demand an apology and ask for Sister Agatha to be disfellowshipped.
I heard the intake of breath and felt my mother's body stiffen at the word. I knew what it meant. I'd seen other Jehovah's Witnesses thrown out for a much lesser crime than being a false accuser.
"Will you apologize to Brother Bowler?" asked Brother Wendell.
I shook my head.
"Will you repent?"
"No." My mother clutched my arm. "Do as they say, Agatha. Tell him you're sorry." "I didn't lie." "It doesn't matter. I'll go to the police."
"Then you will be condemned by God," rumbled Brother Wendell, "and you will be lost to Satan forever."
My stepfather put his hand on my shoulder. I could feel his fingers digging into the flesh on either side of my collarbone.
"Tell the man you're sorry, Agatha."
The pain shot down my arm and my fingers tingled.
"No."
The Judicial Committee glanced at each other and nodded. The hearing was over. A week later, I received a letter with my name, date of birth, and congregation number. It didn't specify the precise offence, but the meaning was clear. I had been ostracised from the church. I could no longer participate in Bible studies or group prayer or freely associate with other members. As a minor, I could remain living under the same roof as my parents, who would take care of my physical needs, but nothing more. My mother could not comfort me if I was crying, or offer guidance or emotional support. My stepfather said to me,
"I love you, Agatha, and I'll be waiting for you on the day you come back. I will welcome you with open arms, and I will say, just as the father said of his prodigal son, 'This daughter of mine was dead, but now has returned to life. She was lost, but now is found.' But until that day, you are alone, because you have chosen to turn your back on God."
Megan. Jack has taken the day off work because he thinks he's coming down with something. He's saying the flu, but I'm calling it a cold until proven otherwise. All morning I've been up and down the stairs.
"Megs!"
he bawls from his sick bed. "What is it?"
"Sorry to be a bother."
"You're not a bother.
Can I have a cup of tea?"
"I'll put the kettle on." I retrace my steps, making him tea and adding a few biscuits, anticipating his next request.
"What are you doing?"
he asks when I bring it upstairs. "Vacuuming."
"Have you seen the newspaper?"
"It didn't get delivered."
"You couldn't pick one up for me, could you?"
"Sure."
"And some throat lozenges. The lemon ones with cough suppressant, not the cherry-flavoured ones that taste like medicine."
"It is medicine."
"You know what I mean. And can I have some soup for lunch?"
"What sort of soup?"
"Pea and ham, with croutons."
"Who was your slave yesterday?" The wind has an arctic bite today, tugging at my coattails and sending fallen leaves skittering across the grass on Barnes Green. I pick up Lachlan from preschool, because he does half-days on Tuesdays. He runs ahead of me, his mittens dangling from the sleeves of his jacket, and his trainers lighting up at the heels with every stride. The supermarket doors slide open, and Lachlan stops to look at the colouring books. I find the pharmacy section and study the different cough medicines and lozenges. An employee wearing a brown smock appears at the end of the aisle. I talked to her a few weeks ago. She's pregnant. I look at her name badge. Do you know anything about cough suppressants? Agatha glances at me nervously and looks away. Is it for you? No, my husband. Does he have a temperature? To be honest, I don't think it's that bad. Agatha moves products aside, looking at the back of the shelf. He wants the lemon flavour, I say. When are you due? You did tell me, but I've forgotten. Early December. We're both having Sagittarians. Should we be worried? I don't know much about Sagittarians, says Agatha. They're very strong-willed, highly sexed, and virile, according to my husband. Let me guess, he's a Sagittarian? Exactly. We both laugh. She has a pretty smile. What does your husband do? Agatha asks. He's a TV journalist. Would I know him? Not unless you follow sport. He works for one of the satellite channels. The manager of the supermarket interrupts us.
Is everything all right?
He asks, brushing down his short moustache with two fingers. Perfectly fine, I say.
Is there something I can help you with?
No, I'm being helped already, thank you. He hesitates. I match his stare. He looks away and leaves. Is that your boss? I ask.
Uh-huh.
He's a creep. Agatha covers her mouth. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. Every woman has had a boss like that, I say, looking for a wedding ring. She notices and covers her hand. I'm engaged. I didn't mean to pry. I know. My fiancé is in the Navy. He's on deployment in the Indian Ocean, but he's going to buy me a ring when he's in Cape Town. That's the best place for diamonds. Will he be home for the birth? Not unless the Navy give him the time off. I glance behind me, searching for Lachlan. He's no longer looking at the colouring books. He might be reading the comics near the checkout. Excusing myself, I go in search, calling his name. I call again, louder this time. No answer. Don't you hide from me, Lachlan. It's not funny. I'm moving quickly, running down the aisle, yelling for him, suddenly aware of a sinkhole that has opened in my stomach. Agatha helps me search. We spy each other at the different ends of the aisles as we cover the width of the supermarket. Lachlan isn't here. Running back to the main doors, I ask shoppers if they've seen a little boy. The manager suggests I calm down because I'm upsetting the customers. The girl at the checkout looks frightened of me. Did you see him leave? She shakes her head. Oh, my God. Lachlan? Lachlan? On the pavement, I look in both directions along the road and into the park. I'm trembling, dizzy. A man walks past. Have you seen a little boy? He's about this high with blonde hair. He's wearing a blue parka. His shoes light up. The man shakes his head. Unwittingly, I've grabbed hold of his arm, squeezing it tightly. He pulls free and hustles away. A bus has stopped across the road. The doors open. What if Lachlan gets on board? He loves buses. I yell to the driver, waving my arms, crossing the street without looking. A car brakes and the horn sounds. The bus driver opens his side window. My little boy, did he get on? He shakes his head. Are you sure? Can you check? The driver walks down through the bus, peering under the seats. Meanwhile, I'm scanning the park, fighting against my panic. There are two people with dogs. A frazzled-looking mother sits on a picnic rug beside a pram. An old man shuffles along the path. The sophisticated parts of my brain are shutting down. I run, calling Lachlan's name, my heart convinced that someone has taken him. My beautiful boy. Gone. Lachlan Shaughnessy, aged 4, with a floppy fringe of hair and perfect little white teeth, and a fierce look of concentration when he plays games or makes believe he's a knight or a soldier or a cowboy. I glance across the expanse of grass towards the pond. What if Lachlan went to look at the ducks? He might have fallen in. I'm moving again, yelling his name, terrified that I'll see his little body floating face down in the water. Scrabbling through drifts of dead leaves, I reach the edge. Ducks explode into flight, their wings beating at the air. Lachlan isn't there. The turgid brown water ripples in the breeze. He could have gone back to the preschool or tried to walk home by himself. He asked for a chocolate at the supermarket, but I told him to wait. He could be at the cafe, looking at the cakes in the window. I run back, but Lachlan isn't at the cafe. Could he have gone to Lucy's school? He's always saying he wants to start school now rather than wait until next year. I start running again, studying every passing car and van and truck, fighting the rising panic. Names pop into my head. Missing children. Murdered children. What am I going to tell Jack? How will I explain it to Lucy? My vision is fragmented and blurred by tears. I can't find him. I must. My name is being called.
Mrs. Shaughnessy!
I turn twice full circle before I see Agatha. She's holding Lachlan's hand. I run to them, scooping Lachlan into my arms, squeezing him so tightly that he complains.
You're hurting me, Mummy.
Relief is like a valve being opened or a balloon deflating. He was in the storeroom, explains Agatha. I don't know how he got in there.
Thank you so much, I say, wanting to hug her as well.
Lachlan wriggles out of my arms.
Why is you crying, Mummy?
Never run away like that again, I tell him.
I didn't run away. The door shut.
What door? It must have locked behind him, says Agatha.
Well, you shouldn't have wandered off,
I say to Lachlan.
I was frightened. I thought I'd lost you. I'm not lost. I'm here.
I've left my shopping at the supermarket. Lachlan takes hold of Agatha's hand as well as mine, swinging between us. Now that the fear has gone, I feel exhausted and ready to curl up and sleep. Agatha helps me pack my groceries, and we chat about pregnancy and the responsibility of raising children. At first glance, I thought she was younger than me, but now I see we're about the same age. She is a little on the plump side, a size 14 to my 12, with grey blue eyes and a nervous smile. I like her quaint northern accent, and that she doesn't have any airs and graces, not like some women around here, who can be quite cliquey and standoffish. She makes fun of herself. She laughs. She makes me feel better. I should invite Agatha along to my mother's group. She'd be like a breath of fresh air. In the same heartbeat, I consider how snobbish my friends can be. Most of them went to private schools and on to university and speak in identical tones. They are socially confident, attractive, and capable of passing muster at any country house weekend or garden party. Could Agatha do the same? How would I introduce her? We should have coffee one day, I suggest, meaning it. Really? What's your number? I take out my mobile. I'm Megan, by the way. You can call me Meg. And I'm Agatha. I know. I point to her badge. We spoke a few weeks ago. You warned me about the wet floor. She looks surprised. You remember? Of course. Why? It doesn't matter. Agatha. Tours are usually arranged by a midwife, says the maternity nurse, who's dressed in dark blue trousers and a navy blouse with white piping around the collar. Barely 5 feet tall, she looks Italian, with thick eyebrows that almost join above her nose. When are you due? She asks. Early December. You've left it very late. I have other options, I say, brushing my hands over my belly. My sister had a home birth and swears by them. It can be a very positive experience if you're healthy with no complications, she says, leading me along the corridor in her sensible rubber-soled shoes. Is this your first?
Yes.
I make a note of how she's secured her ponytail with a simple black hairband and the small watch pinned to her breast pocket. A cheap ballpoint pen is tucked behind her right ear. If we can't accommodate you, I can recommend some community and hospital clinics. Will you be going private?
Possibly.
Who's your obstetrician?
Mr. Phillips.
She stops at a door and glances through a small glass viewing window. I might not be able to show you all the birthing suites. Some of them are occupied. You can take a virtual tour on our website. The corridors are white and clean and bright, pastel-coloured. Calming. We pass a woman wearing slippers and a hospital gown being supported by her husband. We deliver 5,000 babies a year at the Churchill. Visiting hours are at set times for friends and family, but partners can come and go, says the nurse, who shows me a delivery suite with a water birthing pool. This is the postnatal ward. We have a limited number of private rooms, but it's first in, best rest. The tour finishes at the reception desk, where I'm given a self-referral form. Your doctor can also submit an application, she says, but don't leave it too long. I thank her and take a seat in the patient lounge, looking over the form as I watch the passing parade of expectant mothers and nervous fathers emerging from the lifts. Others are going home. The babies in car seats or carry cots, the mothers holding bunches of flowers and soft toys. When I'm ready to leave, I follow the exit signs, making a note of the corridors and stairwells. People nod and smile as they pass, because pregnant women are cute and glowing, and we waddle like penguins. What isn't there to like? There's a note under my door when I get home. Come upstairs. I knock on Jules's door. She answers, swinging it open with a flourish. I see Hayden's mother standing behind her in a tweed twin set, beaming like she's won the pools. I hope you don't mind, she says, giving me a hug. She smells exactly like her house, fabric softener and lemon cake. I have to stop myself stiffening in her arms. How did you know where I live? I ask nervously. Hayden told me. Have you spoken to him? Not since Saturday. He has big news. She breaks the clinch. Jules must know already because she's grinning at me like a court jester. I look from face to face, wondering if I'm supposed to guess. Hayden is coming home for the birth, Mrs. Cole announces. I stare at her, open-mouthed. He spoke to the family liaison department and explained the situation. The Navy don't normally allow personnel to interrupt a tour of duty, but they gave him permission. Isn't that wonderful? My legs wobble. Jules takes hold of my arm and makes me sit. Oh, dear, I'm so sorry, says Mrs. Cole. It's the shock. I should have realized. When? I ask. Pardon? When is he coming home? He docks in Cape Town 2 weeks from today, then he'll catch a flight to Heathrow and should be home just in time. My stomach lurches, and I taste vomit in my mouth before swallowing hard. Jules suggests a cup of tea and goes to put the kettle on. Her little boy, Leo, is watching TV with the sound turned down, occasionally looking at us as though we're invading his territory. Hayden is over the moon, says Mrs. Cole, all fluttering hands and smiles. I know it took him a while to come around, but he's fully on board. He wants to be with you, if that's okay. I feel like Alice in Wonderland sliding down the rabbit hole, trying to stop myself falling into a parallel world. He can't, I say. Mrs. Cole stops in mid-sentence. Jules looks from the teapot. They're waiting for me to explain. I mean, he's doing important work, catching pirates. What if the pirates seize another ship? I saw that movie, you know, the one with Tom Hanks where the captain was taken hostage. Mrs. Cole laughs. They can stop pirates without Hayden. She points to her shopping bags. I've brought you a few things. We'll look at them later. I don't want there to be a later. I hope you don't mind me coming over. I didn't know Hayden had proposed. Who told you? Your friend, Julie. She's so lovely. It's nice that you have each other. Each other? Being pregnant together. I nod, still trying to come to terms with her news. Jules carries a tray to the sitting room. She hands me a mug of tea. 2 sugars. I sip and take a deep breath. I must stop this. I can't have Hayden coming home for the birth. Are you sure it's okay? I don't want to put the Navy to any trouble. It's perfectly fine. My mother is going to be with me. I understand, says Mrs. Cole, but now you have 2 birth partners. I don't expect Hayden will be much use, but I've never seen him so excited about anything. She doesn't understand. I can't explain. I want to be Hayden's wife, and I want him to take care of me. A month from now, he can sail into Portsmouth like a Viking warrior home from sacking cities. But not now. Not yet. Are you all right, Aggie? Asks Jules. You look very pale. It's the shock, says Mrs. Cole. You should lie down. Mrs. Cole follows me downstairs to my flat, waiting as I unlock the door. The place is a mess. I apologize.
Nonsense. You've been on your own.
She makes me sit down and put my feet up as she begins cleaning. The dishwasher is unpacked and repacked. Worktops are wiped. Bins are emptied. Out of date.